So what I want to offer you is two things that I think might be of value to doctoral students. The first is my impression from talking to and working with a lot of doctoral students is that you start off with a big sort of thing, you know, a big question, a big issue, a big topic, a big thing that excites you. And it's almost like a simple story. One of my recent PhD students was doing, so how can we make public participation better? You know, what goes wrong and how can we put it right? And gradually, over the 3 or 4 or 10 or 20 years that it takes, life gets more complicated. And by the time you get to the conclusion, you've no idea what it's been about. Cristal is going to do my slide. The first one, please. This is my big idea, and this is the idea that's coming out in some of the literature at the moment, some of the commentary at the moment. And just before we get into it, I want to say that I'm not a gender and welfare state scholar, but I've always brought a mix of feminist and cultural theory to public policy, social policy, public administration, political science, whatever I'm working in. And so I'm quite interested in the talk that there is around at the moment, and you'll have seen some of it in the papers, that what's happening now disproportionately affects women, and indeed that it unravels the gender settlements that were inscribed in welfare states that have benefited women, both as workers in welfare state professions and as welfare users in terms of benefits and as public service users. That's all being unravelled by the cuts. It's a very seductive idea, and it's one that I sort of agree with, but it's one I sort of agree with politically, but as an academic, I want to trouble it a bit, and that process of troubling is difficult. It's what researchers do. You make it more complicated, and you have to do that without undermining the political significance. It's a paradox, really. How do you hold on to the politics while making your academic work subtle, sophisticated, and complicated, and ultimately worthy of a PhD? Right? The second thing I want to offer you is you end up having done your PhD or towards the end of your PhD with this mass of stuff, an enormous amount of data, an enormous amount of analysis, and you're asked to turn it into a publishable paper. And the research I'm going to talk to you about has been going on over the last 2 years. It was started with a completely different set of intentions. And I now want to make it speak to the big society, which clearly wasn't around at the time. And that's one of the tricks of doing a publishable paper, you know, finding a hook to hang your work on and trying to get it out there in some way. I don't know if this is a publishable paper yet, because I haven't tried. And I don't even know if it's got a coherent argument. This is its first outing. And you can tell me later. So, something about the research itself. This started at a retirement party 2 years ago, and I realised that the room was full of women who, for the last 20 years of their lives, had been working in and across or between the voluntary sector, civil society, professional work, NGOs. They'd had very complicated and fractured working lives. They'd often been in kind of liminal or marginal spaces, on the edge of organisations, in between sectors. They're not, at the peak of their careers. They've not had careers in the sense that we might think of careers. But they'd done enormously important work in keeping everything going and in generating new kinds of practice out of which some of current public policy emerged. And I thought those are very interesting women, I started off interviewing women of my kind of age who come through feminism and other kinds of activism and had taken those commitments into their working lives, paid and unpaid, and then gradually brought it down the generations. So I'm now interviewing people your age, and we'll see what that does. So what I'm trying to do is make all that speak to the present. In the period when I was a young professional, but also an activist in the 70s, we had a big society. You know, we did. There were many, 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 many projects and initiatives and developments that we were generating for ourselves. And you can say, well, that's all hippie nonsense, and it was. We operated in a very different material reality, but we were very active citizens. So, the research itself, can we go on to the next one? This is the philosophy that underpins the research. This is a woman called Dorothy Smith, who talks about institutional ethnography as a methodology. And I'm not doing exactly that, but near that. And the reason I like it is that she talks about research as map-making. She says, institutional ethnography produces a kind of knowledge that makes visible to activists or others directly involved, so it could be your frontline workers or whoever you're researching, the order they both participate in and confront. And although some of the work must be technical, as map-making is, its product should be ordinarily accessible and usable, just as a well-made map is, to those on the terrain it maps. So what I'm trying to do is what Christina said about working across the academic practice boundary and making something that is of value both to the academic world and also usable, I hope, by those that I'm researching. So it's quite a collaborative process of research. If you want more about methods, I'll tell you later. So what I want to pull out of the research is something about how did the policy that is currently being unravelled get made. And in doing that, I both want to trouble the gender question, but also trouble the policy question. What do we mean by policy? And the first quote is from a social policy academic. I've not put names on this because it hasn't been back to them for checking yet. And this is part of her interview. She says, we developed a critique, well, I'll let you read it and then I'll tell you what I want to point out to it. There's something there about the network that she's in. It's always we, and the transcript is littered with the names of both policy actors, academics, and activists, all of whom were part of what we might now call a policy network. Right? The other thing I want to pull out is change over time. So in the 70s, there was a general concern. It got harder in the 80s. But out of the 80s, new groups emerged to take the work in different directions. And the Women's Budget Group, which you probably, have you come across the Women's Budget Group? It did all those calculations about the ways in which women were affected by the cuts and tried to have a judicial review of the 2010 budget. So there's something about change over time and how the political context changes. And then this is her other comments. There were many ministers and civil servants who were happy to use our arguments. You trained them up and then they moved on. We had some big successes. And then this is a particular bit I like, but the label comes off as soon as it gets into government. It's very hard to trace a specific policy back to our idea. You just sow these little seeds and hope that something grows from them. So that's something about the ambiguous relationship between activism. And not just activism, but things that are generated outside somehow. And what happens as they get taken up in government. The label comes off. That's, if you like, the process of appropriation or co-option of the idea, not necessarily of the actors. I'm not talking about the incorporation of individuals here, I'm talking about the appropriation of ideas, their reworking and reshaping them into something called policy. Okay, so that's one way in which policy happens. The second, I've got three ways. The second, and these are spaces of power, this is a policy space of power. The second one is a juridical space of power. Juridical. And a number of the women I interviewed had sort of been around the law in some way, but they weren't having these sort of high-profile, high-paid careers. They were going into the law for political reasons. And while those quotes are up, I just wanted to talk to you, you know, about the Fawcett Society and the Women's Budget Group that have used the law. There's another very famous group who use the law effectively, Southall Black Sisters. Some of you know them. This is a group of mostly, but not exclusively, black women. Not all of them are lawyers. They, one of my interviewees was a founder member back in the 70s. But I also have interviewed a young woman activist who found, you know, her salvation was finding this group and it making sense of her life. And they have done a number of high profile, some successful, some unsuccessful, challenges to policy, the most famous one being Ealing Borough Council, where they were successful. And juridical power is, you know, not necessarily successful, but it challenges policy after it's made, and of course sets the ground for how policy is interpreted in the next round through casework. And Davina Cooper, who is a brilliant feminist governance scholar in the socio-legal department at Kent, has done a book called Governing Out of Order, which looks at such challenges. And she argues that the use of juridical power is a kind of meta-governance. It governs the conduct of public institutions. That's what it's doing. And I like her work very much. Okay, so that's two kinds. Are we all right so far? Policy space, juridical space. The third space of power uses the power of representation and voice. This is finding ways to speak to power. Through campaigns and through influence. And I've got a couple of different examples. This one is about the Lesbian Mothers campaign in the 70s and 80s. And this is about campaigning for custody rights for lesbian couples and for donor insemination issues to get onto the policy agenda. And they've been successful. You know, this is now different from how it used to be through campaigning, through representing the voices of a particular group who weren't able necessarily very easily to speak to power by representing and translating their concerns in ways that policymakers could hear. This is another example. And this is about women in poverty. This is somebody who, until last year, coordinated a Women's Advice and Information Centre that, of course, is now closed. And this is her talking about bringing women who are experiencing poverty. Sometimes it was women and men. She's got a very strong class-based perspective. She's a working-class woman herself. And bringing them into conversations with ministers, civil servants, and so on. And what happens is that when government sets out a consultation exercise or when it publishes a policy, she convenes groups somehow. You know, she finds ways of bringing women in, working class communities in, having little focus groups, generating responses to the policy. And then in this example, taking them on a bus to London. And she combined some campaigning work, picking up issues that have come out of the advice context in which she works, with this kind of representation and voice work. So, three different spaces of power. And what they're doing, those spaces of power, is, number one, it says gender's more complicated than just the gender of genders that are inscribed in what we might think of as gender-friendly policies or something. Because we're here inflecting it with class, with sexuality, and there's many, many other inflections as well. We're also seeing change over time, both the political context, but also in the spaces of power themselves. You saw in the first couple of sets of quotes the significance of feminist institutions. So here we've got a number, we've still got the Women's Budget Group, but in the 80s and 90s, we're moving into NGO territory rather than feminist institutions themselves, and that makes a difference. But the third thing is we're complicating what we mean by policy. And one of the big things that I see a lot in PhD theses, which I read a lot, is the assumption that policy is this text, and you can analyse it for governmentalities and for the constitution of subjects or whatever it is you're analysing for. But policy is not a text. Policy is a set, it is a text, but it's a set of practices, it's a set of processes, it's a set of relationships. And by taking just those three different spaces of power through which it is influenced, we're seeing how it's enacted through practice as well as presented through a text. Those of you who are doing welfare to work type things know this because of the role of the advisor, maybe. But there's many, and I'm a bit worried about that because it assumes that the discretion, you know, the street level bureaucrat stuff, is the only point at which policy, you're focusing on, those of you who are doing this, are just focusing on policy implementation, not the practices of policy shaping, making and enacting. All right. And what this study is doing, because I started off with that perspective and I've elaborated through it, is saying that policy is a constructed and contested term, and it is enacted through processes of translation and mediation and all of that social scientific stuff, which doesn't happen in public administration and doesn't happen a lot in social policy, actually. So we're complicating policy, and I'll do another example in a minute. Where am I? The interviews also suggest some of the ambiguous alignments between feminism and social policy. It's not just one set of things that happened at the moment of the making of the welfare state, which, as we know, was based on a class settlement, not a gender settlement, in Britain anyway. And my generation, the generation that were politically active in the 70s, challenged that class settlement, which had a maternalist concept of gender. You got benefits and rights because of your position as a mother rather than as an independent, autonomous actor. The first quote I put up from the social policy academic was talking about how that maternalist conception had been challenged, but also how those challenges for women to be treated as independent economic and political subjects in their own right, not subject to a male breadwinner, were co-opted by Blair and others into something called the social investment state. So we had economic rationales for gender equality rather than maternalist rationales. Whether that was better or worse, we're not sure. But that led to quite a lot of arguments that are around now about feminism being complicit with the rise of neoliberalism. Women's claims for autonomy and independence but co-opted, or indeed prefigured, the emergence of the notion of the individual, flexible worker, reflexive subject on which neoliberalism depends. Now, that's another big story that, you know, we could take apart, and I'm doing so in other work. But what it suggests, that alignment between feminism and neoliberalism, is we also need to look at women's activities not just as the recipients of benefits or as workers in the welfare state, but their work as generating new social and political imaginaries, new social and political ways of acting. You know, at its very basic, a lot of the stuff on leadership now, you know, participative, human-centred, based on facilitation and empowerment, all of that comes right out of feminism. And it can be good or bad. You know, and men can learn it too. So it's not just about women, it's about ways of acting in the world that generate new rationalities that are readily appropriated by neoliberal whatevers. And so the next... I should just see if anybody wants to come in there before I go on to the next bit. Is this making sense? I mean, my answer to that last bit is it depends what you mean by neoliberalism. That's another paper, you know. But this idea of women's work in generating things is an important part of the project that I started with. And I want to go back to that project now and talk about what I'm calling prefigurative pathways. How a lot of the things that were taken up in social policy and many of the things that are around now, including things like co-production, time banks, you know, stuff, came out of informal activity generated by social movements or in alternative spaces that are now being taken up. So let's look back at some... Right. So these are some of the prefigurative pathways that are evident in the research on which I'm basing this paper. The first one is an older woman who's a GP, who was actually in a collective in the United States, even though she's British, in the late 70s, that produced something called Our Bodies, Ourselves, which was a feminist self-help initiative designed to bring women's health agendas into the mainstream. But it initially operated in an alternative space of women's health groups, which were nothing to do with the NHS, you know. And she later went on to work with the Department of Health in the UK, and her informal work that got taken up by the Department of Health was to generate something called Health Talk Online, which is a way of enabling teenagers to use peer-based support for their own health problems, to get them to talk to each other, just like Our Bodies Ourselves did for us. Except, of course, it's different now. Public participation. Loads of that was going on, and it's now policy. Childcare. Loads and loads of the women that I've been talking to set up alternative, cooperative, self-help, childcare, playgroups, whatever. One later went on to be the director of SureStart. So the trajectory is from that early self-help committed idea through NGOs to senior civil servant role, which she drew on her past experience. Health and well-being. One of the women has come across something called asset-based community development, which is a US initiative that's quite old. which says all this stuff about needs and dependence and professional intervention is rubbish. We need communities to be able to discover and capture their own resources and use them to generate strengths. We need to work on strengths, not deficiencies. And we can argue about what the implications of that are and how easily it fits with a big society. But she's now working on adapting that method to promote new local authority ways of thinking about health and well-being. And she's having a lot of positive response. But she brings a radical agenda to it. You know, it's very interesting. She says, but we also need the state. I just want to finish this list with free school. This might be the next quote. No, it's not. The last one is about a woman who is a radical eco-activist, cycling, transport, all of that stuff. Not in anything very significant in terms of state work, but a lot in the voluntary, unorganised voluntary sector. And she said, when the children were little, I wanted to have them at home some of the time and in school some of the time. I wanted to do flexi schooling. And so I tried to set up a little free school. But all of the people who came, all the parents, just wanted free childcare. So that was no good. So I made an argument, went to the Department of Health and got that into policy, this flexi schooling idea. But you can see that it's between free school. She wanted a free school with parental control and the current policy agenda of free schooling. So things sort of get reworked in ways that lose their edge. Now, all of these prefigurative practices have led to policy innovation. All of them generate new capacities and resources on which policy can draw. And indeed, there's often very close networks between those activists and policymakers. But can this happen anymore? They all had access to Blair's initiative ITIS, you know, which created lots and lots of programs and initiatives and spaces. One of them said, New Labour's been good for us, because it gave us little ways of getting some money to do particular things. So they're a bit worried about the present.